This is the Reason Podcast, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at iTunes, Google Play, Reason.com, or wherever you get your podcast on, and rate and review us while you're there. My guest today is Francis Fukuyama, the Stanford political scientist and author of a shelfful of the most important and influential essays and books of the past 30 years. The titles include The End of History and The Last Man, Trust and Our Posthuman Future. We're going to touch on those themes today and talk about his new work, Identity, The Demand for Dignity and the Politics of Resentment. Francis Fukuyama, thanks for talking to Reason.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Give me the elevator pitch for Identity, which you say you wouldn't have written if Donald Trump hadn't become president won the 2016 election.
My view is that the nature of global politics is shifting to an identity axis away from the economic left-right axis of the 20th century that was defined largely by ideology. And by identity, I mean these fixed characteristics that link us to certain groups, usually based on things like ethnicity, race, religion, it could be gender.
Right, or sexual orientation.
Sexual orientation now in the United States and other developed countries. I think that is not good for democracy because these fixed characteristics are supposed to be determinative of your politics. And in a way, that's the problem in very many countries like Iraq or Syria or, Libya, where everybody is tied to a fixed identity group and therefore you can't have a modern political system.
So, two of the key terms in your book revolve around the concept of thymus or thymus?
Mm-hmm.
Thymus, mm-hmm. Okay, or the desire to be recognized. Throughout the book, you talk about isothymia or
isothumia and megalothumia.
Isothumia and megalothumia.
Right.
Okay, what are those and how does that play into
Yeah, those are neologisms that I created, but isothumia.
Now, you say, I thought you were ripping off Plato or something for that. Okay.
Isothumia is the desire to be recognized as equal to other people. If you're disrespected or invisible to other people, you want to be recognized.
And that's in the United States context, that's the Declaration of Independence saying all men are created equal.
And every marginalized group that says, mm-hmm. You don't see me as a human being, mm-hmm. I think that's what's driving that. Megalothumia is not a universal characteristic, but it's universal to almost every political order, which is you get certain tremendously ambitious individuals who are not satisfied with equal recognition. They want to be better than everybody else. And for a democratic political system, that's a particular problem mm-hmm. because you've got to somehow limit the ability of an individual like that to hurt the rest of the political system.
And are you arguing in the book that obviously there are individuals throughout history who have megalothymia, Hitler is the obvious mm-hmm. one or Stalin or somebody like that. But are certain identity groups now taking on that role where they are demanding to be recognized as separate and greater than other groups or their grievances?
Well, the first manifestation, I think, of modern identity politics was European nationalism. And there, you start with the desire of the Germans to live within their own community because they're all scattered around Central and Eastern Europe. They don't have a single state under which they're all ruled. And then they get that state. And then isothumia, so they just want to be recognized like other peoples. But then the isothumia evolves into megalothumia, where they say, well, actually, we actually ought to dominate the Slavs and, all these other peoples
surrounding
us. Yeah,
and eventually all of Europe or the world. In Italy, obviously, you have a related and earlier phenomenon in fascism, a lot of which Hitler copied for Germany. How much of that is related to the fact that Germany and Italy, at that point in history, at least in their modern conceptions, were relatively new countries that didn't really have stable identities?
It was related to that. I think the people that put Italy and Germany, especially the people that put Germany together, had an entire kind of focused ideology that went with that, that said that there is a German spirit. It was very much out of the romantic 19th century, understanding of the irrational side of human consciousness, and that this is what defined a German as opposed to the rational, money-grubbing Englishman that was just the businessman or trader. We Germans were something different and better than that.
Do you think, you have spent a lot of time with Hegel. When you talk about identity politics in a global context, is this a kind of zeitgeist? Because clearly it takes different manifestations in different countries, but is it being driven by the same kind of world spirit?
Well, the part of Hegel that's critical to this is his observation that politics is driven by the desire for recognition. He doesn't get into this world that we live in where you've got this pluralistic recognition of all these little groups. He didn't live in that kind of society. What he saw were masters and slaves, that masters wanted recognition from the slaves, but it wasn't a satisfying recognition because you're only being recognized by a slave, you know, somebody that's not a full human being. And he saw this play out in the course of the French Revolution where the slaves were rising up against the masters. And he said, you know, ultimately, the only solution to this problem is universal recognition, where every human being recognizes every other human being as an equal. And that's basically the foundation for a liberal society. Mm-hmm. What I think he didn't anticipate is all of these partial recognitions or smaller group recognitions that have become so important in the way that we think about ourselves today.
Well, you write that a lot of political life is only weakly related to economic resources. To kind of extend this thought a little bit, what do you mean by that? And at least in the developed world, are we mostly dealing with symbolic transaction in politics then? Because, you know, poor people are poor relative to rich people, but they're not starving.
That's right.
In the U.S. or Western Europe. Gay people, you know, it might have taken them way, you know, as far as I'm concerned, too long to be recognized for marriage purposes, mm-hmm. but they're not being persecuted or prosecuted the way they were even 30 years ago.
No, that's true. So I think that dignity politics is not about an absolute level of resources or dignity. It really is your standing relative to other people. People like to be, you know, they hate being less than other people. And sometimes they want to be more than that. And it really is, it can be related to money. You know, Adam Smith has this very nice a couple of pages in The Theory of Moral Sentiments where he says, the rich man glories in his riches, while the poor man is invisible to his fellow human beings. And he says, you know, poor people in his Scotland of the late 18th century, they were not, you know, absolutely poor like people in Africa, but what they were was invisible. So he says, you know, the rich man doesn't even see the poor man on the street as he passes him by. And I think that's a really profound insight, that actually the reason that we desire a lot of material resources is not that we really just have to have that beautiful, you know, Ferrari, but, you know, it shows that I'm better than you because you've only got a Tesla or whatever.
But what happens when everybody can buy the car that they want? We're pretty close.
Well, I think the nature of relative status is that it's a perpetual arms race that no one can ever win. And you think about it, I mean, so you used to have millionaires. Now we've got billionaires. We've got multi-billionaires. How do they compete? They always find a different axis, you know.
But this is, and I know in the book you rely somewhat on the work by Robert Frank, mm-hmm. the economist, who talks about a lot about positional consumption. And
yes.
It's all about status. You know, I'm curious if that's actually an accurate reading of how most people live, because it's also, if you can opt out, it's one thing if you're an academic economist or an academic and, you know, you can't really afford the Tesla, but you know about it and you want it. But aren't most people just kind of happy to be able to live a variation of the life they want? I mean, are middle class people, and I'm going into a weird psychological typology, I guess, or, you know, do they really want the newest and best thing? Are they keeping up with the Joneses in a world where the mainstream doesn't really exist anymore and you can kind of follow your own bliss?
You know, I think that flashy material resources are only one axis mm-hmm. of status competition. There's plenty of others, you know, how your kid is doing, right. Whether they're the captain of the football team, whether they're, you know, the... I mean, there's so many ways in which you can demonstrate superior status. So I think this is true in poor communities as it is in, mm-hmm. you know, rich ones. It's really not related to an absolute level of consumption.
To say something like the case which recently went in front of the Supreme Court about the gay couple that wanted a Christian baker to bake them a wedding cake. That plays into your identity politics.
Yes.
Was the gay couple seeking, I mean, were they seeking simple recognition? Was that about dignity, or was that also about forcing somebody who they knew disagreed with them to placate them?
Well, I don't know what their personal motives were. I think in general, the gay marriage movement is, that's just dignity politics right from the get-go, because if it were simply about resources, you could have, you know, joint property or, you know, survivorship or inheritance under a civil union. You could create rules, but the rules would say, but still this civil union is not the same as a marriage. Society does not recognize you as a man and wife or a husband and husband, whatever. And that is what people really wanted. They wanted to say, we are the equals of a heterosexual couple. So I think it really was not related to economics at all. Right. It really was a question of society's affirmation that your bond is as good as a man and woman's. Right. And conversely, I think the people that were opposed to it did not want that judgment. They wanted to say, you know, we believe that the traditional family should have more dignity than, you know, gay or lesbian union, and that's what the fight was about.
And, well, I want to come back to that when we talk about your proposed solutions to identity politics and the fragmentation and polarization that it helps enable or and reflects at the same time. But then you do argue that nationalism and also to a certain degree religious identities in the U.S. and Europe are tied to economic anxiety, especially among a kind of particularly in the U.S., a white middle class that is anxious, either losing ground or is anxious that it's about to lose ground to a wide variety of others, oftentimes immigrants, sometimes black Americans, who they see as flourishing and jumping the queue. Is there a disconnect between talking about economics and kind of symbolic political transactions?
No, I don't think so. You know, my mentor, Samuel Huntington, made this observation back in Political Order and Changing Societies. He was actually extending an observation of Alexis de Tocqueville about the French Revolution. He said that the most dangerous, the most politically dangerous, are not poor people. They don't have resources. They're not. They don't organize well, and so forth. But they also psychologically, there's a difference. He said the most dangerous people are people that thought they were middle class and are losing that status. And so, of course, they're losing resources. They get fired from a job. They don't make as much money as their father, whatever. But the status loss is really what makes them angry, that they thought that they were solidly, you know, representative of, you know, the average person in the country. And now it turns out that they're being dragged into an underclass. And I think that's really what distinguishes the populism that you see in North America and Northern Europe from the kind of populism you see in Latin America. Because in Latin America, that populism really is driven by poor people. Hugo Chavez really lived in the barrios, you know, where you had these pretty desperately poor people that wanted stuff from him. In Northern Europe, it's not the poorest of the poor. Those are actually the migrants or the, you know, the non-white, you know, minorities and so forth. It really is, you know, these older you know, white working class people that believe that they represented the national identity of their country, and all of a sudden, you know, it's filling up with all these foreigners. And
let's talk about that in an American context, because exit poll data from the 2016 elections showed that Trump actually lost with voters from households making less than $50,000. Mm-hmm. Hillary got them. So they're the poor, you know, in this context. And then he beat them among voters from households making between $50,000 to $200,000. Mm-hmm. And then again, people making over $250,000. So he actually had like a really strong representation among the upper class. But in a way, your read there, it's that people between $50,000 and $200,000, which is an enormous range. And $200,000 is a lot of money anywhere in the country. But that makes sense from your reading.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think within that range, there's really different motives. So if you're a factory worker that lost your job because it was outsourced to China, you may be at the bottom of that range. And that's different, I think, from a pretty secure, you know, middle-class professional making $150,000. But you can still be driven by cultural fears because you don't like the nature of the new society that's emerging around you, where all these, you know, different people that don't look like Americans to you are suddenly, you know, being given, in your view, advantages and so forth.
And
so,
and how much, you know, and talking about people who don't look like you, it's not just that, you know, it's people who don't fuck like you, mm-hmm. it's people who don't eat like you, mm-hmm. it's people who don't talk like you. Mm-hmm. What is the role of immigration, particularly in a U.S. context? We have had, you know, over the course of history, obviously, you know, everybody's an immigrant on some level. Mm-hmm. Between about 1880 and 1920 or 1930, there was a massive mm-hmm. immigration, starting again in the 80s until mm-hmm. now, massive immigration. Is that, you know, how does that fit into these sets of anxieties and identity politics?
Well, the number, the percentage of foreign-born in the United States right now is about 15%, which is what it was in the 1920s after the really big wave at the turn of the century.
And it's up from like under 5% in 1970, yeah. which was the historic low point of the yeah. percent of foreign-born.
Yeah, and what happened in 1924 is the Reed-Johnson Act closed off immigration, and then that allowed the country to digest this huge, you know, influx of you know, foreign-born people. I think that things are different right now because, first of all, we're not going to close the gates the way we did in 1924.
Right, and it wasn't simply the laws, right? It was also then the Depression, World yeah. War II, the rebuilding of Europe. I mean, that's people didn't want to come here.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. But I also think that there's other things, other kinds of anxieties that are driving the hostility to immigration. And I think that's what's important to understand, because there is a view out there that says this is just white backlash. And there's clearly there clearly is some of that. I mean, you know, Zoltan Hajnal and Marisa Abravanel at UCSD did this study where they showed a lot of what's driving white voters into the Republican Party. It's no longer race the way it was after the civil rights movement, but it's much more immigration. But I do think that you need to disaggregate some of the motives there, because some of it, yeah, is just plain xenophobia and racism. With other people, I think it's a much more legitimate concern over assimilation, because they worry that, you know, we're taking in people at a rate where they're going to be living in their own communities for, you know,
That sounds like my Italian grandparents who never spoke English and yeah. produced a couple of soldiers, so...
Well, yeah. But, so, no, I'm yeah. not saying that this, I'm not saying this is a correct fear or projection right. of what's going to happen. But I do think that it's more legitimate to worry about, you know, whether you can really assimilate, you know, these different populations. And also, people are worried about the illegality. Mm-hmm. So I think that in a way, if you want to deal with that backlash, you've got to make those distinctions and then tailor your policies to the ones that are more mm-hmm. legitimate, you know, rather than the ones that are just based on racism.
How much of it is also the U.S. kind of managing or acknowledging and managing a decline in relative status among world powers? You know, this is at the end of the Cold War, the U.S., you know, emerges triumphant, where the, you know, we are the superpower. Which is not necessarily the best place to be over mm-hmm. the long haul, but it's clear that the U.S. relative to China, relative to Russia, relative to India or other regions of the world, or the EU for that matter, we're not going to be in charge the way that we might have been right after the Cold War. And just as England, France, Germany, Japan had to manage a decline after World War II, where mm-hmm. they were no longer top world powers. I mean, is that part of what's fueling this anxiety, a sense that we are being decentered from or knocked off the throne on some level?
You know, I'm not sure that that's that powerful an explanation, because you're getting populist parties in, you know, Hungary or Poland or places that never had any illusions that they were going to be a great power and are actually doing. I mean, Poland has been doing great over the last decade, and yet they've still got this populism. I think that there are other parts of the Trump package that does support. I mean, when you say make America great again, well, what does that mean? Well, part of it is, you know, loss of manufacturing and a certain kind of economic dominance. But it's probably also this view related to what you just said, that, you know, there's other big powers out there, and the United States, you know, can't get its way in a way that it thought it could. So
here's a quick sidebar. Are we making too much of Donald Trump's election? He won as narrowly as anybody has ever done in American history. And it's kind of clear, you know, I would say that like Hillary blew the election. I mean, she really ran one of the worst possible campaigns. Is he a new force, or is he kind of a weird emanation of old kind of coalitional politics that have been breaking down? Only, according to a recent, it was either Gallup or Reuters poll, only 27% of Americans now consider themselves Democrat, about 28% Republican, and the rest are independents. Mm-hmm. I mean, clearly, what Republicans and Democrats have stood for is breaking down. And is Trump maybe just a blip of that, but we're building all these new theories?
I think he's more of a blip, but he is both cause and effect, mm-hmm. right? We were very polarized before he ever arrived on the scene, and we had lots of government dysfunction well before he arrived. So he's not, you know, he's not the creator of this, and it'll survive. If Hillary Clinton had been elected, she would have a terrible time governing because the Republicans would probably control, you know, a good part of Congress. Right. And like Obama in his last 6 years, she wouldn't be able to do anything, and there'd be all this, you know, back and forth, you know, really nasty, you know, hatred on both sides. And so
it might have turned out like the first Clinton presidency, right, where in the last 6 years there's actually a fair amount of common ground sought and found.
Well, yeah.
I think it would be harder, obviously, with Hillary.
Yeah, but, you know, the polarization really didn't. I mean, it got started in the Clinton years, yeah. But it's just so much worse now. So I really doubt that would have been an outcome from a Hillary Clinton victory. But on the other hand, I mean, there are some really unique characteristics, you know, that Trump is so intent on breaking every single norm of presidential behavior, of policy, of, you know, in every conceivable dimension. Some of those norms can be repaired, I think, relatively easily, but others, I think, will probably take a much longer time to do.
What's an example of a norm that is broken that, it's really consequential that he's breaking?
I think that, the one that obviously worries a lot of people, including me the most, is just this willingness to attack your own legal system and to try to delegitimize it just to save your own skin, right? And I think that, you know, the attacks on the press are something that's also being copied by a lot of dictators around the world. You know, so Duterte in the Philippines, or, you know, Putin or Erdogan. I mean, they all say, "Well, look, you know, United States is U.S. president is you know, hates his opposition press too, and you know, we're just shutting it down." So those things, I think, are probably, you know, pretty damaging and lasting. Other things, you know, I'm actually kind of worried that, because he's such a norm violator, that if the Democrats come into power, the pendulum is going to swing in completely the opposite direction, and they will then put into formal law these norms that had just been informal, and you'll end up with a excessively constrained president. Because I actually think that, you know, executive power doesn't work without a certain amount of executive discretion.
Now your nightmare is kind of a libertarian dream. Then, like, finally, we get a president who is restricted, because, mm-hmm. you know, we would, I think, tend to say, you know, one of the problems going back at least to Lyndon Johnson is a surfeit of executive power. Mm-hmm. But identity politics, you write in America, and I guess globally too, is primarily an attribute of the left. And it's replaced, you know, a traditional focus on economic security and transfer from the well-off to the desperately poor, a kind mm-hmm. of class-based argument with, you know, with all of these different types of identities. When did that start happening in American culture, and what was driving it? And is it different now? And mm-hmm. let me, that's a leading question. Let me say, you write in the book that this started happening in the 60s. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting about the 60s is that was the tail end, certainly for immigration. I mean, you know, the Irish, the Italians, the Jews had either been assimilated or were about to. The Godfather is this kind of great watershed moment where I always feel whenever an American ethnic group takes, you know, all of them go through a criminal phase, you know, for various reasons. When the members of that group start playing with that identity and use it for cultural power, which is really, I think, what The Godfather is about, it's a sign they're fully assimilated. American Indians, Asian Americans, you know, Black Americans all had this move towards identity politics. There was a movement of Polish power, for God's sake, at a moment when fewer and fewer immigrants were around. That's the beginning of identity politics in America. So How is the source of that, you know, how is that kind of transition now into a world where we now have more and more groups and more immigrants?
I think that, first of all, the thing is powered by actual injustice, right? Mm-hmm. So these are all groups that are actually marginalized in various ways, disrespected, and so they have a perfectly reasonable demand that they, you know, be treated differently. But I think the process of identity group formation has its own logic, where you want to affirm not just that we are like everybody else, but we actually are, have our own characteristics, and actually maybe we're better in some ways and, you know, distinctive, and we aren't going to be just like other kinds of Americans. And there's also, I think, this
what fraction. What is an example of that, of a kind of left-wing identity politics group? Because I get what you're saying, and it registers with me, but then I see in, you know, say a movement which is often assailed by people on the right, like Black Lives Matter, mm-hmm. you know, that started out of, you know, anger at events like Ferguson or the killing of Trayvon Martin, where the, you know, the actual moments are kind of a little bit vague because mm-hmm. you have, you know, or certainly with the case of Michael Brown and Ferguson, where mm-hmm. he's a criminal, you know, character who gets killed by the cops. And it helped trigger, you know, a revelation to a lot of America that the police were acting categorically differently towards blacks and mm-hmm. particularly mm-hmm. poor blacks. Black Lives Matter makes total sense. Mm-hmm. I don't see them as saying we are superior to you. But mm-hmm. what are the groups, left-wing identity groups, who are saying, you know, shut up and listen to me because I should be the only one talking?
I don't think you've seen assertions of superiority in quite that fashion, but you certainly have seen assertions of cultural distinctness and then the demand that you respect those differences. And that's true, I think, both of African Americans and women. With African Americans, Martin Luther King, you know, his demand was just to be treated like other Americans, like white Americans, mm-hmm. you know. But in the Black Power movement, there was a view that Black culture is not white culture. It has its own, you know, virtues, and it needs to be respected as a group identity rather than, you know, individual black people being treated as Americans. It's even more pronounced in the feminist movement because right from the beginning, there's a standard or there's a train of thought that says, yeah, women really are fundamentally different, and in certain respects, they're better. They're mm-hmm. not violent. They're not, you know, they're more empathetic. They have their own ways of you know, approaching, you know, social cooperation and so forth. And it's really the men that are imposing this very, you know, aggressive, violent, patriarchal culture on, you know, on the rest of society.
So in, I mean, you are not arguing that identity politics are just, is simply wrong.
Oh, no.
I mean, what you're arguing is that when it gets to a point where it says, because of my group identity, I should not be criticized, I should not be forced to submit to any kind of cultural norm, or where does identity politics cross a boundary?
So there's a couple of different boundaries. So one of them is that this intolerance for, you know, in a sense, otherness or the ability to cross those lines. I think that this is more of a problem, I think, in Europe than in the United States, but the assertion that all cultural groups are basically equal is problematic. And this has been a real issue with the Muslim immigrant communities in Europe. I want to be very careful because this is kind of delicate ground. Right. But, you know, it is true that, you know, there are cultural values in these communities that is not, you know, does not treat women well, does not treat homosexuality mm-hmm. The way that the mainstream society does, anti-Semitism, you know, all of these problems are, you know, embedded in their cultural values. And you can take one of two positions. You can say we live in a liberal society where our values are to respect the rights of individuals, or we live in this kind of pluralistic, multicultural society in which we say all cultures are equally valuable, even if some of those cultures oppress individuals that mm-hmm. are members. And I just think in a liberal society, you cannot possibly take that second position.
And that second position is kind of like the Dutch pillarization concept,
well,
where you don't actually try to assimilate. You create identical
parallel communities.
Yeah. And that always gets messy too, because it can't really account for individuals who want to be free to choose among communities.
Now, you know, there are many countries where that's the inevitable outcome. I mean, in the Balkans or in the Middle East, you have these identity groups and they all live in regionally concentrated areas that their ancestors have lived in for centuries. And, you know, there's no way that you're going to treat these people simply as individuals. But I think that if you've got a country like the United States, where you actually don't have this kind of, you know, ancient, you know, identity organization of your society, you should not want to move in that direction.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your proposed solutions that tease that up. How do we get out of, you write identity politics are kind of, you know, driving political correctness or the unwillingness, particularly on college campuses, but we see this throughout public discourse, an inability to have conversations because to even interrogate or just ask an honest question about somebody's assertion of an identity is to is to disrespect them. So we can't have a conversation. Mm-hmm. What are the ways that we get out of this, you know, really kind of stultifying moment that we're in?
Well, I have a very simple solution, which is we need to talk more about integrative identities and particularly national identity. In many cases, that actually means fixing the national identity, because in Europe, especially in continental Europe, you actually have identities that are tied to ethnicity. So in Germany today, if a Turkish person, a German citizen of Turkish origin who doesn't speak a word of Turkish, only, you know, German, gets up and says, I'm a German, you know, people will look at him a little bit strangely and say, well, yeah, actually, you're not a German, you're a Turk. And that's something
But that it's better than it used to be, because if you're a Turk, you can actually be a German citizen now.
Well, you
right?
can, but
in
culturally,
a way that you couldn't. Yeah.
No, but culturally, there still is not this kind of acceptance of a, you know, a non-ethnic German as a real German. And so that needs to change. And that's actually embedded in their citizenship laws and, you know, and other things. But if you do have what I call a creedal national identity built around a set of ideas that is open to the actual de facto diversity of your society, then the task is to assimilate people that come into the society to those values, because they need to share them with, you know, the existing citizens of the country. And so it's a kind of twofold thing, that immigration, I think, is a good thing. It's positive. The diversity is very bracing, and it stimulates a lot of creativity. But in the end, if you don't actually shape, you know, these groups to your basic underlying political values, then you're headed down a kind of
in the United
road.
States, though, is there any reason to believe, you know, because this is something that comes from the right mostly, you know, this is the problem with letting Mexicans in, and including Samuel Huntington went right up to the, you know, to the wall of racism, but it was that Mexicans, they come from a different tradition, they're not going to be assimilated. And if we just, you know, we're just importing Democratic Party voters who are going to vote for a bigger welfare state, et cetera. But it's not the Mexicans who are, you know, who are they're not anybody's problem in this sense. It's, you know, it's rarefied sexual orientation. It's, you know, established, it's black groups on campuses. It doesn't seem to be people who are new to the country who are asserting, treat me, you know, don't tell me how to live and give me lots of money. It's people who have been here for a while.
That's true in the United States, but, you know, in Europe, you do have immigrant communities where there really is no social mobility out of the, you know, out of the community. And that, you know, if it persists over generations, that can be, you know, I think that can be quite
absolutely. But
dangerous.
In the United States, I guess, and maybe if I could ask you to, you know, kind of riff on your own biography here, because, you know, I'm sitting across a table from a guy named Frank Fukuyama, and you're Japanese American?
Yes.
Okay. Were your parents immigrants, or were they?
My grandfather and my father's side immigrated from Japan,
so,
and my mother did.
You're a super elite American academic. How did the process work for you in a way that it's broken down now, where we're not seeing ourselves as, you know, one country made up of many different types of people?
Well, you know, when I was growing up, if people ask me where I'm from, I say I'm from Chicago. And If they said, well, yeah, but what are you? I said, I'm an American. And I think that, you know, it was only when I was older in the 60s and 70s that people began to hyphenate, you know, their identity to reflect that ethnicity, because there was a greater popularity of, you know, looking at your roots and so forth. But, you know,
And again, it was also there's an irony, right, that people start identifying in more ethnic terms at the precise moment where you were no longer barred from access to every aspect of American society.
Yeah, I mean, that's right.
I don't know if your parents or grandparents were in internment camps, but I mean,
no, they were.
It was really fucking tough to be, you know, any number of immigrant groups or black in America. Mm-hmm. And why does it seem as conditions get better, people actually start referring back to these categories, which, you know, are disappearing, not as part of who you are, but, you know, as actual obstacles to full integration into society?
You know, that's a very difficult psychological question to answer. I think that in a way it could be related to a kind of narcissism of small differences, that as you become more secure and you rise, you start worrying about different things that, you know, really shouldn't have bothered you when you were, you know, in a worse position, because they're just not as serious. But, you know, now they do. But yeah, my family, they were all sat out the war in relocation camps, so they were not well treated. But, you know, so that was a really big lapse in American policy. But I think my experience, and also I heard my father saying this as well, I mean, he didn't think that apart from that experience, racism really made any, you know, obviously there's kind of small change, you know, petty racism. But he said, I can't think of a single time when, you know, racism prevented me from doing anything important that I wanted to do. And that's been my experience as well. And so, and I also grew up thinking, you know, it's pretty neat that I can say that I'm an American and, you know, nobody laughs at you.
How much do you think that events, and I'm thinking, you know, particularly in terms of ethnic and to a certain degree, racial identities, an event like World War II, which was an all hands on deck, everybody, I mean, there were, I don't understand this, although I have a variation of it, of, you know, there were actual people interned in, or Japanese in internment camps, Americans of Japanese descent in internment camps who volunteered to fight for the U.S.
No, my uncle did that.
Yeah, and I'm thinking my, one of my uncles on my mother's side of the family, he was the son of Italian immigrants who volunteered to fight, and he ended up invading Italy, you know, a country that his parents had left 20 years before. How much did that type of event where everybody in America kind of banded together allow for a kind of assimilation, of like where finally Americans couldn't say, okay, well, you're Japanese or you're Italian or you're black, so screw you, you're not
really
American.
I think that, you know, you probably wouldn't have had the whole civil rights movement in the beginning in the 1950s if you hadn't had World War II, because when the United States went into World War II, it had to justify why it was fighting fascism, you know, thousands of miles away from American shores. And so you had the four freedoms and, you know, a lot of rhetoric about democracy and so forth. And when Americans look back at their own society, you know, the South was still segregated. There is, you know.
Yeah, I mean, the armed forces were segregated. Yep. And, you know, it seems absolutely the case that the civil rights movement was driven partly by black soldiers coming home and then being treated as second-class citizens. And they're like, yeah, we're not going to stand for this anymore. So, you know, one of the things you talk about, one of the ways out of kind of fragmentation of national identity or of common identity is, you know, by emphasizing these creedal qualities of America, which, to be blunt, I think is kind of bloodless. It's like, you know, it's one thing if we say, well, we're a nation of immigrants as well as we believe in the rule of law, et cetera. Everybody is different, but we're united by something. But one of the things that you say that will drive listeners to the Reason podcast nuts, and I hope everyone else, but is national service. How does that work in your sense?
Yeah, well, it's a bit of social engineering. I mean, I'm not a libertarian, so
I understand you're under no obligation to espouse libertarian thoughts, but I'm like, what? And I guess here, let me flip it kind of more on me. All of Europe, which used to have national service, they all got rid of it. Mm-hmm. You know, is that part of the problem, is that we don't have something like a draft? We don't have national service.
It didn't produce a very good army, but I think it did. You know, and this is true not just in the United States, but in Israel or South Korea or other countries that have a serious, you know, face a serious military threat, and all men, and in fact, you know, a lot of women as well, you know, are forced to serve. But it serves some good functions. So first of all, it teaches you that you actually owe your country something other than just obeying the laws and paying taxes, that citizenship,
God,
you know.
Shouldn't that be enough?
No, I don't think, I mean, there's a Republican understanding of, you know, modern democracy that says that, you know, part of what it means to be a human being is to be public-spirited, you know, and not just minding your own business, you know, in your...
Well, this touches on some of the themes in the Last Man essay and work that you've done. I mean, do you feel that we are kind of in, you know, to use a once defunct, now current again term, late capitalism, that, you know, we really don't have that much to do, so we don't have any lofty ambitions. It is just about this kind of positional spending, and that we're missing that kind of raw experience of a higher purpose?
I talked about all these issues in the last few chapters of The End of History and The Last Man, that what a capitalist democracy produces is peace and prosperity. Not so well, you know, these days, but, you know, it basically does that. But people want more than that. You know, they want more than this endless consumer satisfaction. They want challenges. They want... You know, they want to conquer injustice. They want to do great things. Not all of them, you know, are Hitlers or Napoleons. You know, some of them want to go save, you know, people from AIDS in Africa. Or
that's but you can do that, right? Without making people commit 2 years of their youth to national service.
Well, okay, we'll get back to the national service. But I mean, I'm just saying that psychologically, people do want more than kind of endless material security and accumulation. That's the thumos you know, side of them. I'm not saying that national service does that, but I am saying that it would have a very beneficial effect, first of all, in terms of our class structure, because one of the things, you know, the results of the kind of inequality we have is that apart from the military, we have no institutions that force people to mix across class, race, regional lines, and national service potentially could do that. And I think that, you know, it's a socialization mechanism. I mean, it teaches people, you know, certain virtues of citizenship and, you know, this idea. I mean, you see this, or I see this really in the military officers and their families that I know. They really do have an ethic of service, right? That they could have gone to Wall Street or to, you know, into a business where they'd made tons of money, but they have this feeling that, you know, I owe the country something. And
I don't disagree with that, but it seems to me it's important that it's an all volunteer force too, because it just seems such a violation of all of my grandparents were immigrants and they came here to escape, you know, national service programs, which would have just led to early deaths for my grandparents or grandfathers anyway, as human father.
Well, I think realistically you're not going to get mandatory national service, so it would have to be voluntary.
So how would the, one of the things that you touch on in the book Identity as well is the role of kind of new media or social media, because all of this stuff is playing out in a different way. And there's absolutely no question, and you acknowledge this fully in the book, that one of the great things about, you know, kind of a networked world or a globalized world where you can find people like you anywhere around the world, you know, that's all good. But then it also allows for, there's a negative potential to this. How is the internet or how is social media driving fragmentation?
Well, I think that's pretty obvious. I mean, you know, this whole idea of a filter bubble, because you can search out people with identical views to your own and you can shut out deliberately other people's voices, it tends to amplify, you know, that kind of, you know, group-oriented belief. And because the internet is so expansive, you can find, you know, like the six people in the, you know, among the 6 billion out there in the world that actually believe, you know, the crazy things that you believe. So I think that it is a contributor to it. I think that the you know, the underlying drivers started well before the internet and social media got going. But I do think that the technology abets this kind of partitioning. You know, I referred at the end of the book to this Neal Stephenson
novel. Yeah, I was going to bring that up, Snow Crash. From 1992. Talk about that and how, I mean, do you think we're living in the snow crash world?
Well, in a certain way, a lot of it has come true. So this was written in the 1980s when the internet really had not gotten going. So he posits something called the metaverse, where you can adopt an avatar and move around in a virtual universe. But the United States itself had fallen apart into a complete fragmentation. And so every suburban subdivision was a sovereign entity, and you needed visas and passports to pass from one subdivision to the next. The federal government was now restricted to only the property on which federal buildings sat. The CIA had been privatized, and it was now a kind of global knowledge company. The aircraft carrier Enterprise was a refugee ship, you know, a big raft, you know, for floating refugees from around the world. But essentially, it's the opposite of the 1984 nightmare. The 1984 nightmare is, you know, totalitarian, centralized, brainwashing government. And in Snow Crash, it's the opposite. It's that everybody, you know, has their own thing. And so the races have their own New South Africa and, you know, the Chinese.
And it's odd because it's not, I don't think it's a world I would choose to live in. It might be the world we're living in, but it also has certain positive attributes to it, right? Because people are sorting. I mean, it's also kind of like an Albert Hirschman dream of exit voice and loyalty, because you can kind of affiliate where you want to be.
You can affiliate, but it also means you do have places like New South Africa, you know, where, you know, blacks are not allowed. And, you know, frankly, I mean, that kind of world, you need actually social organization at levels higher than a suburban subdivision if you're actually going to do things in the world. So I think it's not a very sustainable kind of society.
And to tie just in a couple of questions, I'd like to talk about identity in relation to some of your earlier works. In your book, Trust, you talked about the link between social, economic, and political trust and goodwill, and in the subtitle, The Creation of Prosperity. In the United States, and this is as far back as the survey data goes, trust in public institutions, in private institutions, in nonprofit or third space institutions, everything is going down. And, you know, my quick read on that, especially if you think about something like government from, you say, the Vietnam War on, it's like, people are right to have less trust and confidence in the government. In many cases, the government was openly lying, secretly lying, or incompetent. You've changed your mind, for instance, on the Iraq intervention, partly because it just didn't work out very well, and it was sold on a bunch of lies. What you know, is identity politics is it the cause? Is it the effect? Or is it more complicated? How is it related to that ongoing depreciation in trust and goodwill among people for, you know, for these institutions?
Well, I think it reflects this broader decay of large institutions, you know, the Catholic Church or labor unions or General Motors, right? All of those institutions have been declining. Trust in them has been declining. And it is, I think, related to the fragmentation, the social fragmentation of the larger society. So you only have trust where you have shared belief in legitimacy and honesty and, you know, the goodwill of, you know.
Do you find, you know, and this is a banal, I guess, example, but in certain types of apps, you know, whether it's Uber or Airbnb that codify reputation and then at least show it to people, you know, is that a way to start building things back, or could that be adopted to larger organizations like the government, you know, because part of what drives identity politics is a sense that the government doesn't care about people like me.
Yeah. Well, you know, so there's a whole game theory background to this where trust can arise spontaneously in an iterated game where you're constantly playing against people, and then certain people screw you, so you stop cooperating with them, but other people are honest and, you know, you do cooperate with them, and so you develop a norm of trust spontaneously. And I think that could happen with the government as well. I mean, if the government were seen doing things, you know, part of the reason I think there was such a high level of trust in the U.S. government in the early 1950s is they had gotten the United States out of the Depression. I mean, some people contest that.
Yeah. But at least one person in this conversation. Yes. But yeah. No, but we won World War II.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, and did it in a relatively, you know, efficient amount of time. I mean, you had these big public works projects like Hoover Dam or the Golden Gate Bridge.
The interstate. Well, Golden Gate is more complicated, but yeah, the interstate highway project, absolutely.
So I think, you know, that's the case.
But then that ends, I mean, it's weird that that ends with Eisenhower telling, I mean, explicitly telling the country, you know, be worried. We're like, we've got a military-industrial complex here that is taking over. It's a, I mean, it's kind of amazing.
Yeah. That, well, there's a lot of reasons why, you know, the government at a certain point stopped working, which is, you know.
Do you think that, it, you know, and we're even now, we're taping this during the kind of a brief pause in the Brett Kavanaugh confirmation hearings. Who knows what's going to go on there? But, you know, that's a place where the Senate is, you know, both sides have not covered themselves with glory and kind of being transparent and being truth-seeking. They seem to be very interested in partisan gains. I mean, do you have any sense, particularly in the Trump years, that the government is going to do what it might do to actually encourage trust and confidence in, maybe not in its efficacy, but at least people are acting in good faith?
Well, I think you need a different administration.
Yeah, certainly. Trump, right.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he personally, I think, does everything he can to actually decrease trust in himself, except for the, you know, his core supporters. You know, it's hard, and it's hard for the federal government to do this. I think you could have that buildup of trust at lower levels of government, because there are a lot of municipal governments that do actually work pretty effectively. And so, you know, you might get some bottom-up movement in that respect. I think in order to get a more effective federal government, you'd have to do such radical surgery that, you know, and I don't think the political basis for that is there.
But is that a long-term pessimism, where it is just that in a big government, and obviously Bill Clinton famously declared the end of the era of big government, but big government is kind of like General Motors. It'll continue on, but it'll never be the pace setter that it was. Or it might even be more, I don't know, you know, like Sears Roebuck, where, you know, or A&P, where you're a giant and then you just disappear because it can't reform itself.
We have particular problems. I mean, you know, if you look around the world at other democracies, there are other rich democracies that work pretty well. Mm-hmm. People trust their government, you know, Commonwealth Canada, Australia, you know, Germany, the Netherlands, most of Scandinavia. I mean, these have governments that are very big. They do a lot of stuff, but they're seen as doing it well. And I think that's part of American exceptionalism. I think that there are quite frankly, we have such a anti-statist tradition that you libertarians are contributing to.
I would like to think that we won the argument that government is ineffective and bad most of the time. I'm not sure. You know, I write a lot about how that erosion of social trust, weirdly or ironically, actually calls forth more government, because people in low-trust countries want more government regulation of every aspect of their lives.
But it does, I think, the distrust of government traps you in a kind of low-level equilibrium where you say the government is not working, therefore, you know, why pay my taxes? Why give it more resources? Why give it more authority? And then because it doesn't have resources or authority, it doesn't do a good job. And then people say, ah, see?
But we're also at the end, and this is true everywhere, of the kind of Bismarckian welfare state. It's unsustainable from an economic point of view, unless you restrict immigration, unless you restrict, I mean, you have to, it's hard to maintain that over time. So it seems like we need a different paradigm.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of European countries are going to, you know, their welfare states are going to survive, you know.
Yeah, well, we'll see how many Muslims are living in Sweden, right, in another 10 years or so. And they have also, you know, it's interesting because Canada has a very high percentage of foreign-born people and a relatively robust welfare state. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there are, you know, certainly examples that you could point to. To talk about dignity in your earlier work, does the post-Cold War turn to identity politics, and obviously it was starting before that, but you know, the post-war ends, Cold War ends, there's a sharp turn to identity politics on religious and nationalist grounds, as well as other things. How does that either contradict or validate your theory or your thesis in The End of History?
Well, if you go back to The End of History and The Last Man, the book, the last several chapters are really about identity. I mean, I talk about thumos and I talk about megalothumia and isothumia as forces that could potentially upset this democratic end of history, because generic recognition as a human being, which is what democracies do, is not enough for people. They want special forms of recognition. And that's why I left the book. You know, I said nationalism and religion are not going to disappear. And also, we may not have solved the Donald Trump great man problem.
Right. You know? And you point out with, I mean, this, you must have felt great on some level when he was elected president. You talk about him in that book
did,
as a particular. What was your quick thumbnail sketch of Donald Trump back in the early 90s?
The idea is, how do you prevent a Caesar from arising in a modern democracy? And you know, one answer is checks and balances, but another answer is you let him make $1 billion as a businessman.
Yeah, you let him buy, you know, rip off Merv Griffin in Atlantic City, right? and then that's so you were wrong there too,
yeah,
right?
I was.
Because it's
I was.
Like you didn't expect him then to do a leverage into politics based on his popularity.
Well, it turns out he wasn't that great a businessman. He goes bankrupt, and then he goes into entertainment, and
just when the floor can't get lower, he goes into politics.
Yeah.
Right? So. Well, we are going to leave it there. We've been talking with Francis Fukuyama, the political scientist, whose latest book is Identity, The Demand for Dignity and the Politics of Resentment. Frank, thanks for talking to Reason.
Thank you very much, Nick.
For Reason, I'm Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at iTunes, at Google Play, or at Reason.com, or anywhere you get your podcasts on, and rate and review us while you're there. Thanks for listening.